Welcome to the Maine Historical Society podcast. These podcasts explore the experiences of Maine people in a changing world and the connections between local, state, and national history. To learn more about our programs, please visit us online at www.mainehistory.org/programs.
Hello, and welcome to another virtual program with Maine Historical Society. I'm Kathleen Newman. It is October 13th, 2021. And this is our book talk on Bigfoot in Maine with Michelle Soulier. Michelle is a writer and an artist who lives in Portland, a graduate of the Maine College of Art and Design. She owns the Green Hand Bookshop, where you can find her most of the time. And her home is shared with her husband, Tristan Gallagher, and their two cats, Meep and Mr. Biscuit. Her work, both written and drawn, is driven by curiosity and inspired by Maine history, the Maine landscape, and how we respond to it. Her work as an editor of the Strange Maine Gazette and its companion blog gave rise to her first published book in 2010, Strange Maine, True Tales from the Pine Tree State. And since that time, she has been working on the book we're going to discuss this evening, Bigfoot in Maine, whenever she can, traveling around the state and interviewing eyewitnesses for the book. Michelle, thank you so much for being here with us.
I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So we're here tonight to talk about your latest book, Bigfoot in Maine. So I'm going to start us off by asking you, can you tell us more about specifically what inspired you to write this book or to research this topic?
Sure. Back when I started the Strange Maine blog, one of my very first posts was about my response to running across a story about a Bigfoot type creature in Maine. And at that time, I hadn't really heard much of anything about that. And I am very curious by nature. So as soon as I ran across that, I started thinking, I'm like, really? What is this a thing? You know, and wanted to find out more about that. And it's been quite a long road, but it continues on, and it's still incredibly interesting to me that, you know, everybody associates, well, most people associate Bigfoot with the Pacific Northwest, maybe some of the southern states like Arkansas and Florida. But quite honestly, almost every state in the U.S. has its own stories in this vein. And so it was a real eye-opener. And it's been an interesting journey to research it.
Absolutely. Can you give us a quick history? And I mean, in your book, this history spans, I mean, in the modern era, I would say starting in earnest in like the 1950s and 70s to today. But could you give us a quick history of Bigfoot sightings in Maine? It looks like they go probably as far back as the 1700s, maybe even further. But again, that it really starts to peak in like the last 60 years or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of tantalizing hints kind of buried in much older Maine history. I might be wrong, but Champlain, I think, mentioned some very strange beings that he encountered on the coast way back in this exploratory era. What I found in my research, like the earliest stuff was probably sometime in the 1700s. There was a giant skeleton found up in Deer Isle, which I have not been able to trace. just a gigantic human skeleton, which was found entwined in the roots of a tree with a more normal sized human skeleton.
Wow. When was that discovered? Do you remember?
That was discovered in 17, and the other problem,
ballpark it.
doing historic research, it's tricky because a lot of the times it's written into town histories, which this one is in the Deer Isle town history book. And what they'll do is they'll say, you know, 150 years ago. So you have to ballpark it from when they wrote the book and track it back, because I still haven't been able to find any primary sources for it. So yeah, so in the 1700s, it was discovered. And then apparently a local doctor of some sort took over the skeleton. I think that was the, let's say, oh no, the 1700s stuff. I stand corrected. Deer Isle was probably found about 1830.
Okay.
But the 1700s stuff was more in the veins of wild men. So strange, hairy men appearing in the fields, picking crops illicitly and running away from people, or sometimes threatening them. But those, there's a lot of wild men accounts, which are in some ways tied to Bigfoot accounts. They're sometimes related and sometimes the line blurs, but a lot of them are just people who, you know, are basically feral humans, or people who had just, you know, lost their minds and their faculties as a result and had been reduced to almost an animalistic existence. Finding actual Bigfoot stories is really tricky and doesn't really pop up until the late 1800s. When you start encountering stuff like people running across a giant gorilla-like creature when they're out berry picking. So there's a lot of tantalizing hints of wild men and creatures prior to when the newspapers started picking up stories, which we are able to access now. I know we're going to talk more about historic research, but one of the most tantalizing things is knowing that there are probably stories buried in diaries and journals that haven't been digitized yet, and that, or, you know, and probably lots that have been destroyed over the years, and just knowing that somewhere somewhere there's some more interesting stories,
right? One of the things question that just came to me as you were talking was, how do we account for that? Do you think it's that question of just like the records aren't available, they aren't there, or is this something that people just were hesitant to talk about until a certain point? What do you think?
I think that I would hope that diaries and journals would be a key, because I think people even back then kept this stuff private. The story of the wild men in Gorham, in the Gorham and Scarborough area, which would have been the late 1700s, that was given to the fellow that wrote the Gorham Town history, as an affidavit by a man who had been a child when it happened. So I think there's a lot of stuff that people kept close to the chest, maybe only put in their personal diaries or journals if they kept them, which never made it onto the printed page. And were available only as word of mouth and then disappeared over the years. The newspapers, as they started to pick up sensational stories to sell copy, I think in some ways, I mean, it muddies the waters, but it also does us the favor of actually making sure some of this stuff is still available to us today, because there are a lot of newspapers archived and increasingly more digitized, which allows us to search through broad archives to find what we're looking for.
So I know that you utilized in some ways the collections at Maine Historical Society for your research. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Oh, sure. I honestly wish I wish there were more hours in the day, period. Right. But researching archives takes so long. And I love that part of the process. Maine Historical, I was able to get in there several times. Jamie helped me a lot, Jamie Kingman Rice, especially actually with the Gorham story I was mentioning, because they have the manuscript there of that history of the town of Gorham. Unfortunately, it's a very neat manuscript, which basically replicates what came out as the final book. Mm. So apparently they were very fastidious in their authorship. but one of the other things that I still want to dig more on is Charles Asbury Stevens, who produced a prodigious amount of short stories and articles when he was writing in the late 1800s and early 1900s, stories which hint of story, because a lot of his work was based off of his own experiences and his friends' experiences. And he repeatedly returns to the story of these hairy man beasts that are harassing campers in remote regions, to the point where some Bigfoot researchers today consider those factual. Although I won't go that far, I would say that, you know, there's a good chance that he heard stories from somebody which caused him to write those. But I dug for many hours through what was available at Maine Historical, trying to find more. And I wasn't terribly successful in finding what I wanted, but in the process, I did manage to unearth a manuscript for a story that was in the files that you guys didn't know you had. So I was able to go to Nick and say, hey, look,
that's very cool. I do love those moments, or to hear about when people have those moments of when they find something that just nobody knew was there or had forgotten about, or when you were looking for one thing and then you find something completely unexpected.
Yeah, it was very exciting. So I felt like it gave me an opportunity to kind of give a little back.
Yeah. So where else did you go besides Maine Historical? Like, where do you, if someone else was interested in kind of digging into this topic, where do you go?
Maine has a lot of smaller historical societies across the state, which, you know, except for opportunities they've had to digitize stuff through you guys and through grants, a lot of it remains undigitized, but it's there if you want to go use it for your research. So if you're specifically researching one area, the local historical society in your town or adjacent town or your county is probably rife with all sorts of interesting stuff that will, you know, not only give you new details, but also give you context for all the things you're trying to figure out. So I would definitely recommend to anybody who's doing local research, don't overlook that teeny tiny history.
And the people that work there or volunteer at those places are usually, you know, good authorities on all things local. You know, they would, they would know where, who to point you to or what to show you, because they know their collections and their town history probably better than anybody else.
Yeah, they absolutely do. And the other place, the place that I use, of course, because I'm in Portland, is the Portland Room at the Portland Public Library, which is a phenomenal research resource. Abraham Schechter, who runs the Portland Room, has, you ask him a question, he will find you the answer if it is in his power, and he unearths the most amazing things. And he'll remember later that there was stuff you were looking for. So if he comes across it somewhere else unexpected, you'll have this little email pop up in your inbox saying, hey, look what I found. Here's an article from the 70s about this lake monster on the Canadian border. You know, so it's, librarians are, and archivists are some of my favorite people in the world.
Absolutely. So, and the other question I guess I have too is, you know, those are some of the places you can go for your research. It sounds like you found some cool things at Maine Historical. What do you say to the librarian, or if you're looking digitally, like what are the phrases that you use, or what, I mean, do you say I'm looking for Bigfoot, or do you start somewhat with something else?
I tend to take a pretty oblique approach when I'm doing requests directly to librarians, because I have sent requests to a gazillion librarians all across the state and across the US. And I tend to couch it in historic terms because that's really the primary interest. And so I say, I'm looking for the story in this area of time, possibly involving this person or this place. And I know it was in this newspaper, but I don't know exactly when, you know, and try to set it up in that vein. Mm-hmm. And then as if they ask for more details, then sometimes it gets into, you know, what in reality what I'm really looking for. And a surprising number of librarians have been delighted to find out what I'm really looking for because they like something interesting, you know, it's something new and different that they haven't been asked for before. If I'm searching, I also use digital newspaper archives, which are a mixed bag because the text recognition is not always spot on. So you sometimes have to get very creative with how you search using keywords. And you will find a surprising amount of intriguing stories if you simply search in a region for something with the phrase strange creature.
So let's talk a little bit more. So in the book, you talk about sort of the idea of like what, when we're talking about when people say Bigfoot, like what does that mean and why you think a place like Maine could potentially support some kind of creature like that. But a lot of your book is talking about people's encounters or their stories from Maine. And it sounds like that a lot of the people that you spoke to described feeling isolated or even ostracized because they had this experience and not always willing to talk about it. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Definitely a lot of them, especially if there was any sort of press attention at the time, if it leaked to the press, there was usually a huge backlash from, neighbors, coworkers, family members in the area that would continue for decades and decades and decades.
Wow.
If you escaped the notice of the press and you tried to tell your family and friends about it, you know, 9 times out of 10, you would get laughed at and they think you're crazy. Or you imagined it. Or were you drinking that night? You know, like,
right,
like
right.
There's a whole thing of possible explanations for why you didn't see what you know you saw. So that's definitely part of it. What was the last part of the question?
I think you say in the book, you think it's important for people to share those stories in spite of, you know, maybe that fear of being ostracized or not taken seriously, because the stories help flesh out Maine history. Can you speak a little bit more about like what you think that means? Why is it important for people to talk about stories like these?
Well, I think that, you know, Maine, a lot of Maine recorded history is dry historical facts, names of politicians and businesses, and it can be difficult to engage people when that's all you have. But that's not all we have. Maine has an amazing history of really interesting people who had very exploratory natures, risk-taking natures, people who are willing to go out and do things that other people would have either scoffed at or not dared to do. And I feel like these accounts and these experiences, which happened in Maine and happened to Mainers, are that you can't discount them as part of our history. It's all interwoven together. And each time you learn a little bit about one of these accounts, you also learn about the community that surrounded it and how it changed over the years. The context is incredibly important. And that's part of what I try to bring to each of the accounts when I can, because a lot of obviously the majority of Mainers live in Southern Maine, in coastal Maine, near Portland. And Maine itself has so many different versions of itself spread throughout the state. And I think that unless you have had a chance to experience those for yourself, you don't realize how much is out there and how different life can be just on an everyday level. So yes.
Yeah, it's another piece of the puzzle, or like another thread in the tapestry, if you will, that kind of just like just fleshes out the whole history of the state. And I like what you say too about it, you know, giving context to like a particular place and time, even beyond like, I think I saw something weird. It's about what else was going on in the town at the time. Who lived there? How did they react to this story? How did the media respond to the story? There's so much else to look at and consider beyond just someone says they had an encounter or they saw something really strange. So how did you collect those personal stories? How did you like go about soliciting them?
Well, I was lucky enough that I had a couple of friends who were reporters at the time who did little articles, which kind of put that out there in the Lewiston Daily Sun, Mark LaFlemme, and then in the Bangor Daily News, one of my other friends who isn't a reporter there anymore, he's moved on to do other things. But those got me, I think, maybe two or three of my very first stories. And that was important because that's taking the step from doing archival research to doing interviews for oral history purposes is a very different research method. And it's a real challenge to step across that line and take that first step and make that first phone call and talk to that first person, like the butterflies that that causes
right,
the first few times
right.
you do it. And I still get like a little amped up when I have to talk to somebody, but now it's less nerves and more anticipation. So that's been a good shift. But anyways, yeah, so that kind of started the ball rolling because I tried posting on my blog about it, but I didn't really get much in the way of responses. And I had talked to people more vaguely like years before when I first started working on the book, when Lauren was going to be doing most of that end of things, because he's experienced in that, Lauren Coleman is. And, you know, I might've taken brief notes, but the little piece of paper got lost and, you know, so this is kind of recovering old ground. And then I started doing things like looking around online at old, like comments on old stories, which pertain to Bigfoot in Maine, and just kind of rolling the dice and trying to match that comment with a real person that I could get in touch with to see if they wanted to talk to me, and had a surprising amount of success doing that. A lot of times because people were ready to talk. They'd spent decades not talking about what had happened to them because they were worried about what people thought, and they were at an age where it wasn't really an issue anymore. They were like, I don't really care what people think at this point.
Yeah.
I know what I saw. And if somebody else there saw saw something similar and they're going through what I went through, I want them to know that they're not alone in this experience. They're not crazy. There are other people out there who have had the inexplicable happen to them. And you know, let's make this less of a rarity, you know,
right.
for people.
And so now that the book has been published, are people coming to you with more stories? Like, do they continue to come in?
Yeah, I have definitely had a few more come in. Even before the book got published, I had a few right at the beginning of the year, folks that I talked to. So I was already kind of back in that groove again. And I have a few I need to get in touch with and set up interview times with right now. So yeah, it's been really interesting. And the odd thing is that I've talked to probably at least half a dozen people so far this year. And the ones that I've talked to so far, everything has all been in the same kind of two county area, like 30, 40 mile radius, and like decades apart in some cases, but like none of these people know each other. And they just all happen to talk within these few months, and I'm kind of like, what is going on over there? It's exciting. Yeah. And I think because I'm already kind of rolling with the momentum from the first book, I think the second one is definitely not going to take over a decade.
Quite as like long. Yeah.
So it's really interesting.
Now, I really enjoyed the book, and I want other people to check it out as well. And it's available through the Maine Historical Society store. I shared the link in the chat, so you can buy it online, or you can visit us at our Congress Street location at 489 Congress Street. We're open Wednesday through Saturday. You can come purchase it in person. So I don't want to give away everything that's in the book, but could you maybe like tease like one of the stories or one of your favorites from the book? Just give us a little taste.
Sure. One of my favorites there's a whole cluster of encounters around the Brunswick and Durham area, all in the 70s. There have been ones since then, but the two in particular I'm thinking are in the mid to late 70s. No, wait, 73 and then 76 through 78. So, and I was able to go to the locations because Brunswick is nice and right. Adjacent to Portland. Mm-hmm. That was a good trip. I went out with one of my friends who's a Maine guide, and we went into the woods and, you know, looked around to kind of get a feel for the landscape, because the landscape becomes a huge part of these stories. Mm-hmm. And one of the areas we were looking in was where one of the eyewitnesses grew up. He grew up on the River Road in Brunswick, in an area that's surprisingly undeveloped still, mm-hmm. And still has lots of wooded acreage near the Androscoggin River. And he was a teenager, and he spent a lot of time out there tromping around himself. He, you know, prided himself on being able to sneak up on animals. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a game he would play. And while he was out there, he started encountering something else, something that was not, you know, wasn't a moose, wasn't a bear, wasn't deer, wasn't another human being. And he kept getting these tantalizing hints, you know, ferocious howls and roars, trees being broken at really tall heights, in a threatening manner, like, you know, in a sort of a territorial kind of scare you away kind of action. Mm-hmm. And so he, you know, initially, you know, ran home because terrifying when that happens when you're alone out there at night. And then eventually he got really curious and started going out more and more and trying to, when something was following him, he tried to
come like real quick. And yeah.
And discovered that they were very, very fast. Mm. He was on the track team and he was like, if it's a man, if it's a guy, I can catch him. Mm. He could not catch whoever it was. And then eventually he came out one day onto this little bluff area over a ravine and looked down and he saw one. And after that, it was a whole new game. It was like a whole new world. He was just like, okay, this is something different. So his mom ran a kennel. And so he was surrounded by animals all the time. And his mom was also really into National Geographic. So they had a subscription. Yes. Mm-hmm. And they watched specials on TV. So he was already interested in what the primatologists like Jane Goodall and all that fabulous little cadre of primatologists doing as they tried to habituate primates to having somebody nearby observing them. So he thought, you know, what can I do to to try this out in real life? So he went through this whole thing of trying to get them used to him being there, trying to figure out ways that he could interact with them. And I'll let you guys read the rest in the book. But he, you know, as he put it to me, he said, you know, growing up and being able to spend all my time in the outdoors there, with all this, you know, amazing animal life everywhere, you know, including some unexpected surprises, was like living next to Disney World. You know, to this day, he is just kind of in wonderment that he was lucky enough to have that opportunity. So,
and I think, you know, a lot of people that live in Maine, that's like a common theme, like how lucky we are to be here and to just this be in this place. And so that's a great main story in that sense too. And it's interesting, I thought it was interesting, some of my favorite stories that were related in the book were about people that they'd had this experience when they were very young, and that, you know, the impression that it had left on them, and that's one of the good examples of that. So I personally, and I want to get to some questions from the audience too, because those are coming in, I personally have never had an encounter that I would say is a Bigfoot encounter, although quite eerily, just before we went live, I heard something howling in my yard, like two very distinct kind of like werewolfy howls at the moon. That was probably just the neighbor's dog. I'm sure there's like a very solid explanation, but I did think it was kind of weird that on this evening of all evenings where we're about to sit down and talk about Bigfoot, that something like that I've never heard out here before, I could hear very distinctly. Have you ever had any kind of experience?
Nothing that really lines up with a Bigfoot encounter. Not yet. Mm-hmm.
Not yet.
And I'm hoping that's partly just because I try to get out in the field as much as possible, but I'm also a small business owner, which means overtime constantly. So I hope, you know, eventually someday that will happen. And try to keep putting myself out there just to see what happens.
Sure. So a couple things the audience is asking, and we've gotten one comment, you know, I want to read this book. When someone reports a sighting, do they talk at all about observing like differences in gender with these creatures? Like, oh, I could tell it was male, female, or do they comment on that at all?
That usually gets glossed over. And usually if it's brought up, it's brought up by me with the follow-up questions.
Sure.
And most of the time, I would say the people I've talked to have said they weren't able to determine actual gender, at least anatomically. There are some encounters where there'll be multiple creatures, like a family group. Mm-hmm. And in those cases, there are differences in behavior that might indicate a difference in gender and gender roles. But I think I've only had one guy say to me that, what did he say? There might've been a bit of a dangler there, you know? But that's only one guy out of, you know, dozens of
people. That's one way to put it. Yeah. I know some other questions. So that question and comment came in over the chat. Some people have posted a couple in the Q&A, which I'm going to apologize. My screen is acting up on me a little bit and those aren't visible to me, but I know when I looked at them earlier. So whoever asked those questions, if you want to just put them in the chat, make sure I get them correctly. I know someone was asking something about like, do we know when the very first sighting in Maine was, and when was the most recent reported sighting in Maine?
Sightings appear to be ongoing. So the recent stuff is very recent.
It's like this year, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And so far as the historic stuff, that's really tough to say. Like if you take into consideration C.A. Stevens, Charles Asbury Stevens's stories as having been drawn from somebody else's encounters. And he wasn't the only writer from Victorian era Maine who wrote about Maine encounters with wild men in the woods. Those would be the late 1800s. The first time that there is an article which says something about, you know, a mysterious ape man in Maine is the J.W. McHenry story from 1855 in Waldoboro. And that, from all the descriptions in the, because it did make it into the newspapers at the time, the descriptions, to my thinking, when looking at existing primate species, it sounds like it may have been, I think it was a black spider monkey that it sounded most like, based on what it was eating or what it was willing to eat and its stature and the way it was, its coloration and its hair. Mm-hmm. So that's not a Bigfoot, but it's definitely, it was the headlines pushed
right,
in that direction.
Right.
We didn't have the name Bigfoot at that time. So Ape Man was a thing. Mm-hmm. And then there's one, I think it might have been in the 1880s, where a giant walking gorilla was reported, being seen by a group of people and leaving footprints the size of saucers or something like that. So in the berry fields. So yeah, so there I would say earliest kind of prototypical Bigfoot would have been the 1855 one. Mm-hmm. And then moving into the 1880s and 1890s, you see a lot more stories about all sorts of varieties of either gorillas or wild men. There's a really famous piece that Nitinoy Ricker up at, I think she was writing for Bangor Daily at the time, but I think she's with Fox up in Bangor now. Mm-hmm. She unearthed an actual article, which was about a wild man who had been slaughtering people in one of the lumber camps. So that's a pretty sensational
story
from that era. So yeah, it's a real mixed bag, but they're out there.
My apologies to anyone who's typed another question in the chat or in the Q&A. I'm having technical difficulties and both my chat and Q&A have frozen up. I don't know, Michelle, if you can see any other questions that have come in.
Yeah, actually they're one of them was the one you just mentioned, which was, where was the first sighting of Bigfoot in Maine, which we've kind of discussed. And where was the most recent sighting of Bigfoot is the other question. Wow. Well, I probably don't know about the most recent sighting of Bigfoot yet, but I know that there's definitely appears to be ongoing activity up in the Skowhegan area, which is being pretty thoroughly discussed by the people who live up there. Some interesting stuff going on elsewhere, like I camped at the Bradbury Mountain Park just this past weekend with the Maine Bigfoot Foundation, and they had had some reports from the park rangers there that some interesting stuff had been happening around the camps that people couldn't really explain. So, and that's fairly close to the Brunswick and Durham stories in my book. So there's a long history of activity in that area. Kind of along the Cumberland and Androscoggin County borders.
But what's interesting too is the stories do seem to come in from literally all parts of the state. It doesn't seem to be confined to just one place, right? Yeah.
Yeah. No, there are areas where I think there's more human activity, and so more activity gets noticed.
Sure.
But from the sounds of it, it's prevalent throughout the state, and there are just areas where there aren't people to talk about it because they're not there to see it.
There could be all kinds of activity that we just don't know about. Well, thank you again so much for being here with us this evening, for talking more about this. The book was a really great read, and I want to encourage everyone to check it out. Again, if you visit mainhistorystore.com, you can find copies. If you're interested in visiting our store in person or just visiting Maine Historical Society, learning about becoming a member or how you can do Bigfoot research or any kind of research of your own, visit our website, mainhistory.org. And Michelle, your bookstore, the Green Hand Bookshop, that is at greenhandbookshop.com, correct?
Yes.
And also we can find some of your Strange Maine articles at strangemaine.blogspot.com. And people can also follow you online on Instagram at Green Hand Books or at M. Soulier for more Strange Maine content, and of course cats, which is just as much fun, right? Well, thanks so much, Michelle. Was there anything else you wanted to say before we close out for the evening?
I guess maybe just to say that, you know, to people in the audience, don't ever assume or don't ever take for granted your local history. There's always so much there waiting to be discovered, and you just have to look and ask questions, and stuff appear. It's all there waiting for you.
Very well
and
said.
It's an exciting thing to start to find out more about it. It really fills the picture in.
Awesome. That's a great note to go out on. Well, thank you again, Michelle, and thank you to our audience for being here, and I hope we'll see everyone back here soon for another virtual program.